accession number 6365, reel 2.
Accession number 6365, reel 2.
Colonel Glover, reel 2.
Well, we went down, as I said, to the Somme area for training, and we were slap in the middle of the last, of the first battle of the Somme area, and my batch, it was at Longueval, which is a famous and extremely bloody place in World War I. It had a wood which I think New Zealanders had been cut to pieces in, and it still wasn't grown up, and they were still digging up all kinds of old bodies, shells, anything, all kinds of stuff, all the time. And there was we had a gun park in the edge of Longueval Wood, which was growing up a bit by this time. And we had a young and rather nervous chap who was having his leg pulled fairly hard by his thing on guard. And they said, of course, if you're there at midnight, you'll have a phantom battalion come walking through. He said, you want to watch out for that. And something happened about midnight. And this poor chap got up on top of his camel and stood there. He was absolutely scared stiff. And then, of course, the other came around and the officer thing came around and found him standing up on top of his camel, absolutely shaking like a leaf. Oh, he said, I thought I heard a phantom thing. But it was very much, you know, you couldn't avoid them over one. And as I say, I had this history, visual history of this particular, the Battle of the Somme, which my father had been involved in just down the road at Thiepval. And it was very interesting to take these maps and this book and walk up and see where the trenches and everything had been. And I was able to see it on the ground. It was fascinating stuff. And it gave me, when I take my people out for a route, much something to do, you know, just not march along the road, but to go and spot it all. And actually, one of another thing is, so many of these places I knew by heart, because my father had a battle map of the Somme in his downstairs loo. Great big one. And I used to sit and do my morning prayer. And I was from an age of about 10 upwards, and I was really well versed in this map. And I knew just where everything was. And one of the places was called Colin Camps, which was always fixed in my memory, because my name's Colin. And it so happened that later on in this that month, when we were actually doing some exercise at that time, I was just outside Colin Camps when I got the message that my eldest son had been born. When I just thought, well, I thought, well, really, that is the most remarkable thing. I've known about this place all my life. I've never been here before. Here I am, and I get my eldest son born here. Anyway, we were down there, and some of the regiment went down to fire the guns of at Cisson, a short practice, which was, they were the guns of 4th Medium Regiment, which was a regular regiment, and they were on pneumatic tyres. They were down at a French firing camp, and I remember nothing about it. I don't think I could have gone. I'd remembered if I had. But we were there a very short time, but we did fire. You know, everyone got a shot. I think I stayed behind for some reason or other.
Just going back for a moment to the Vimel area,
yeah.
What were the duties of the unit there?
We were absolutely, really, we had to do indoor training. It was cold as hell, the roads were frozen, we weren't on a move, all pavé. Anyway, I really remember well about, I was mess secretary for some unknown reason, and we ran a highly successful mess. Large whiskey was fourpence, large gin, whiskey and soda was fourpence, with Vichy water. Large gin was threepence, and we made a profit equivalent to £100 per officer in the month, and so we were there. Really, it was quite remarkable. And when we finished, just before we had lunch, we had a little pub next door to us. It was cheaper for one officer per day to buy two bottles of champagne than to buy the other eight a pint each. And a jolly good champagne it was, too. We drank it out. Actually, the day before we left, we'd finished it. Couldn't get any more.
You said that in the Somme area you took the men out to see the sites of the First World War battles.
Right, right.
Were there any problems in keeping the men entertained whilst you were in France?
We had to work fairly hard, I think I can say that. We paid what was housey-housey, or, you know, in a village hall or whatever. Fairly every evening we tried to do something or other. There wasn't much in the way of female company for them. We used to take passion wagons into Amiens on Saturday nights from Longueval, which is about 25 miles down the road, and try and keep them out of trouble. That was a popular... Albert, which was a little town, a famous one of the Leaning Virgin. I don't know if you've ever seen the picture of that. Probably, there's probably a picture here of it. That had been all rebuilt. And it was pretty dour little town. There was really nothing at all. So we used to send the trucks into Amiens when we could. And I think this was fairly closely regulated by the, you know, by the command, because they didn't want the place full of it. You were allowed to send so many men each week or something like that.
Was there any problem with the soldiers misbehaving in any way in the towns?
Oh, he got drunk a bit. But nothing bad. You know, you sent some regimental police down with them. No, one or two people got out. One of my... I had to defend. For some unknown reason, I was picked to be off prisoner's friend to a chap who became very alcoholic. He'd been alcoholic before he left. He really shouldn't have come with us or anything. And he used to get terribly drunk. And he did something he shouldn't do. I forgot what he... Anyway, he was up for being drunk, and I disobeying an order, etc., etc. He was still drunk next morning and couldn't get out of bed and all that kind of thing. And I had to defend him. I'd never done before. I mean, I'd never done anything. And I got the military Manual of Military Law, which is the most splendid book. Right? With that in your pocket, you can do almost anything. And I read it all up, and I pleaded that he was ill and had a thing. It wasn't any good. He was just drunk as a newt. And was drunk as a newt next morning. Drunk till about 12 o'clock. But that was very rare. On the whole, we were a very nice lot of good, straight country boys who enjoyed their beer, obviously, enjoyed them. But egg and chips and a couple of glasses of beer was our idea of fun.
So there was no problem with men making themselves ineffective through VD or anything of that kind?
There was a little of it. We had various warnings. I remember the MO used to give us lectures on the horrors of ED, etc., etc., and made you want to decide. And of course, there weren't very much. And you were going to be sent straight home if you did, and that was a disgrace to your family and you and everything else. No. But on the whole, I think there were a few cases, but really remarkably little. Because, I mean, places like when we were at Vimel, the nearest town was Lille. And that was pretty hot stuff, one way or another.
What, for brothels?
Yeah, and very expensive ones too. I mean, comparatively expensive ones too. And good restaurants and good brothels, I suppose.
What about entertainers from Britain? Did they come out to entertain the troops?
They did, certainly to the bigger areas. And I think we sent people in. I don't remember going to anyone myself, really. I used to go in for Leo for Saturday night sometimes. But I don't really remember.
You said that you organised trips around battlefields, but...
Well, they were more walking trips, so to speak.
But did the officers organise trips around civilian sites or organise social contact between the civilians and the soldiers?
No, not at that stage. No, we didn't. We were really fairly busy. You know, we were learning, we were trying to get up to date in various things, we were doing a lot of drill and certainly other. And, you know, I think we fired Bren guns and rifles, etc. We did a fair amount of small arms training, which we could do.
You mentioned the rifle firing and Bren guns. Was much attention paid towards infantry training?
Yes, I think there was, because we were beginning to realise that, you know, you might have to defend your gun sight, so to speak. I remember, and we had a funny old thing called a boys' anti-tank rifle, which was a .5 rifle, an absolute sod to fire. It gave you an awful black bruise unless you gripped it very hard. I'm quite useless against any tank that I know. But we tried out all this stuff.
Would all the men in the unit get practice on the boys and on the Bren?
I wouldn't have thought everybody. Mostly. Yes, I would think pretty everybody would, really. I don't know if we train the cooks or anything necessarily, but...
Was there much contact with the French army locally?
None. Not at my level. We had a very nice French lieutenant interpreter, a charming chap, who used to sort out many problems which required... He lived at RHQ.
After you'd had the training session in the Somme area, did you move back to Vermel then?
No, we moved back to... did we? A place called Aix-Roulette, which was quite close to Arras. Again, this was in... We moved in mid-April. We were, I suppose, about 8 miles north of Arras. And we were a famous, Aix-Roulette was a famous place in World War I. And the extraordinary thing was that their nice little village, much nicer than, what's that famous, better stop thinking about it. It was very close to Vimy Ridge. And that had been preserved in some way, and we went up and looked at that and things like that. But in the big farm, which we were a lot of chaps billeted in, it had been used by Royal Artillery horses in World War I, and all their names were over the stalls. It was very interesting to see all the British names of the horses over the stalls. They'd never been, it must have been long before, it had been 10 years or something, I'm interested. But it was interesting to see all this. And they were much, they were all more forthcoming, those people. They were not so dour as the miners and things. And we, you know, the local pubs were much more fun, so to speak, you know. We took over one which we always used to, the officers always used to go to, and the other thing. And they were altogether a less dour thing. And we stayed there until the balloon went up on... 10th of May.
Can you remember the 10th of May and what you were doing?
I can indeed. The sanitation wasn't all that good, so we'd built an officer's loo up in the woods. We were having what I would call social crap. A most beautiful morning, and the wood was full of bluebells. And all of a sudden, we heard a hell of a row. And we kind of got up and looked out towards Arras, and there was Arras being bombed. The first bombs I'd ever seen in my life. I suppose that isn't quite true. I'd seen some in the 1914-18 war, but... the one thing that struck me, the first time I saw shelling and the first time I saw bombing, I'd been brought up by my father looking at the Illustrated London News. And battles had always been in brown and black and white. And it looked quite unbelievable on a perfectly beautiful May morning with blossom and blue sky and thing, to see all this red dust coming up. And, you know, all in glorious technical. I've never forgotten it when I first saw a real bombing attack on a village close by. It was the most beautiful morning and looked quite unreal.
Did the German attack take you and your brother officers by surprise?
Oh, yes. I mean, well, you know, things had been hotting up, and everyone... Well, surprise is not the right word, I don't think. Everyone realised the phony wars, you know, couldn't go on forever. And what the hell were we doing if it was? But, of course, we knew the little about it. And we stayed there for a week, wondering what the hell was going to happen to us. Everyone was moving away and moving up through the frontier. But of course, the reason was we had these terrible old guns. We only get 10 miles an hour. They wanted to move them by train up to another place. So our guns went off on the 15th of May. And we didn't go till the 18th of May. Now, unbelievably, we had no knowledge at all of what was happening around Calais. And we left Aix-Noulette at 4 a.m. on the 18th of May. And I believe the Germans arrived that afternoon.
You were heading for Calais, were you?
No, we were going up into Belgium. We were... I can probably show you one here. We left on the 18th, and we advanced by Bethune, Armentières, Comines, Menin, Courtrai, and ended up at a place called Oyghem, O-Y-G-H-E-M, where we found the vehicle party. And we went, or the CO2 and the adjutant went to the meet the CCMA of Three Corps, which is a new lot we hadn't come across, and got some orders and proceeded to do some reconnaissance at a place called Anselghem, A-N-S-E-G-H-E-M, which is kind of sideways, slightly southeast, southwest of Oudenaarde.
What were you looking for?
Well, gun positions. We hadn't got any guns, I may say, but we were told to deploy and pretend we got some, because we expected to get our guns any time. Now, our guns had had the most extraordinary history. They had disappeared. They had gone off and had arrived near Brussels and were unloading when the Germans broke through and the flats were taken away and orders were received to put the guns out of action straight away, as no one could do anything about them. And that would have been great. But we had two fairly spirited chaps called McQueen and Brennan, who were both second lieutenants, and they succeeded in getting hold of a Scammel and turning each 8 guns behind each and got them away, travelling at high speed on that rubber tire, on their what's called tires. And they got them to, that's 8 of them, and the other 8 went off by train to Courtrai, and then the railway staff made an error and sent them on to Lille. Anyway, in due course, we got some of them back. I mean, when the hell, we got 8 on the afternoon of May the 20th. But they were in a hell of a state, and we could only make... We cannibalized 5 of them and got 5 in action by the fitters working all night. And, you know, they really were. Their wheels were broken, their tires were hanging, their spokes were loose, their obturator pads were in a muddle, and they had a great difficulty getting off. They failed to run up, and they really had a hell of a business. However, they got some into action. And they fired the first round at 7 p.m. on the 20th. But we had terrible trouble trying to keep them in action. Well, we got a message during the night that the enemy had broken through Oudenaarde, and we were facing one, our zero line was 140, and we had to take it round to there, 30. In fact, what had happened is that the the Belgian army had packed up. We didn't know this, of course. And they'd packed up. And we have by this time realized we had to protect our gun positions, even if we, you know, we just act as infantry or something. And at 11 o'clock on the 21st, a lone flew over our gun positions. No, there was no opposition at all, other than chaps firing at a rifle. And, took all our positions down, so to speak, and shortly after that we got a lot of... The chaps had come round by this time. The infantry had had a hell of a time in front. And we... the enemy came from a place called Petitjim, and our infantry had a hell of a time there. I mean, I think they were the Buffs or Royal West Quints or something like that. Anyway, this chap flew over at 11 o'clock on 21st, and about 4 p.m. we moved, luckily, to an alternative position because we couldn't face round our resistant one, and they shelled it at 4 o'clock just after we'd gone. We were delighted. We did A and B troops. We really hadn't got enough guns for everybody, you know. So we kind of shared them. And A and B troops fired some at the afternoon at a place called Meldon, where we could see the chaps coming across the river. And this chap, extraordinary fellow, Phil Brennan, an Irishman, great big tough rugby player. He was braved for total foolhardiness. He had no imagination whatever. And he was occupying ROP, which he was sitting in a very large plate glass window, watching the Germans approach and coming down the other end, give us a running commentary of the battle he saw it, and being shelled at the same time. I mean, anyone with any brains at all would have got out of the worm, got into the garden, and sat from there and watched him. But no, not Phil. He was sitting down drinking beer and giving us a marvellous running commentary. It was just like being at a rugby match. I can see him coming down here. That's a pretty good shot somebody's had. Yeah. He wasn't actually directing fire because he hadn't got any guns, but he was just... However, he killed himself eventually by doing something similar. That went on, and on the 22nd, we took over the guns, five of which had been in action, and then we got another seven guns. They'd tried to get workshops to take a Jeep. They'd only take one of them. They said the rest weren't worth worrying about. And we took over those guns. And on the 23rd, we were preparing to... We thought we were going to have rather good fun because we had the enemy fully in view. But at that moment, we got a ceasefiring call because there was going to be no more ammunition coming. And it was going to be a group of this time, the Kelly thing, had really cut the thing up. Now, I don't think... A friend of mine was sent off in a truck back to somewhere near Cherbourg, where I think, for some spare parts. And he had the most extraordinary day. He left very early in the morning. He got pushed more and more to the east, and couldn't go south because the Boches were there, of course, and he kept on hearing, you know, Germans in front of us. He didn't know anything about us. He didn't know any Germans there at all. Anyway, eventually he landed up in Calais, where his truck was told to say, get on the boat. And he said, I can't get the boat. He said, we're going down so-and-so. He said, don't talk about it before. He said, Germans are all there. So he was pushed onto a boat, arrived, and before he knew it, he was at Victoria Station. He rang up his wife, who happened to be in London, said, come and have tea with me. He had tea with him at Victoria Station. He then sometimes came back. So he went back to Dover, was forbidden to get in the boat, jumped on a boat, arrived in Calais again. Calais this time was a very hot and unpleasant place to be. However, he met two other chaps who were also equally keen to reckon their own units. They stole a truck which had been abandoned, and although it was considered impossible, drove straight through the German lines, and he was back at midnight with our regiment. I mean, it's almost beyond belief. Set off in the morning, have tea with wife Victoria, be back here, and regiment at midnight.
Was he an officer or another
officer? Yeah. However, that's it. He was a very tough customer, I must say. He wouldn't. He wasn't going to take any of nonsense. Chef who said you can't get through that. Oh, he said, I'll drive that. Anyway, this is the kind of thing that was going on, of course. Well, then, on the 24th, was a day I shall never forget, because about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was sent for to RHQ, and they said, Colin, go and do an officer patrol down that road towards Oudenarde. And Oudenarde was a fair-sized town. Do I mean Oudenarde? No, I don't. Yes, that's right. And I really didn't know what an officer's patrol consisted of. So I went off on a motorbike. They said, go down the road and see how far you can get, see if you meet anybody, you know, Germans, anybody you like, Belgians, see if you can find any Belgians to start with. And I went off down the road and got as far as I was told to go. I'd seen absolutely nothing. A few odd horses, a few odd straggling civilians, but not a sign of anybody. Just incredible luck, because I was surrounded by Bosch, apparently. And I went back again. I said, no go. Oh, they said, well, you better go again. We think there are some Germans there now. So this is at 10 o'clock. I went off again on my motorbike. I took with me this time a loaded rifle over my shoulder. Good motorbike. I had an ordinary 38 revolver of my own and a very nice Luger 9mm, which my father had given me. So I felt, you know, as if I had no armors myself. And I went off down the road, right into the centre of Oudenarde, and it really is the most remarkable feeling. It's a fair-sized town. I mean, I suppose it was about the size of Colchester, I would think, at the Fall War. And there wasn't a bloody soul anywhere. Absolutely, totally diverted. And I remember going to, some of the lights were on, and there was a camera shop there. I always regret it. I went in there, there was nobody there at all, but there was an extremely nice Leica camera just sitting on the shelf. And I thought, well, shall I take it or not? I was dying to take it. I thought, oh, no, I bet not. I'm not supposed to loot, so I didn't. There were films and God knows what. I mean, I wish I'd had, because I'd have got some splendid faces out of it. But I didn't. And then I heard something coming up the street. So I sat on my motorbike, loaded my rifle, prepared for action, so to speak. And all that happened, first of all, was an old horse came running up the street. Poor thing, he didn't know where to go to. Clomped up the street. And then I had nothing to do with it, I couldn't feed it. So off it went. And then I heard some shouting coming. Again, I prepared for action. This is about getting on for midnight. And all that appeared was an extremely drunken Belgian soldier who had a very nice Schmeisser machine pistol, which he wanted to sell me. He said, I've got no further use for this thing. Why don't you buy it? I said, well, what do you want for it? I was quite keen to have it myself. Oh, he said, I forgot what it was. About 400 or something francs. Anyway, I had nothing in my pocket. I had about 150 francs. So he wouldn't sell it. So he went off into the dusk again. And I waited there for about another half hour. Couldn't hear anything, couldn't see anything. So I went back. I went back to RHQ. And I said, I've been to this place, showed all that where I've been to. No, can't see anybody at all. Nobody. Not even Belgians. Not even civilians. Nobody. Well, he said, that's very important information. We know the Belgians have given up. It's very important there's no enemy there. You better go yourself back to CCMA and tell him.
Colonel Glover realised afterwards that he had made a mistake and that the town was not Oudenaarde, but Courtrai.